Something didn't catch. Now we're going. Okay. And it's together, it's a project to gather the stories of Kentuckians as they have lived through the pandemic. First question I'm going to ask you, Shelton, is what were you doing and what was your life like right before you realized the seriousness of COVID?
Yeah, so kind of like the week that COVID really became present in the United States, and when I say present, clearly it was already a disease that was moving around, but publicly present in the news, the work that I was doing, I was spending my time in airports traveling. I was averaging about 3 cities every 5 days, living out of a suitcase, and I had a trip to Atlanta from Louisville, and then from Atlanta to Los Angeles, where I was headquartered out of. And the trip to Atlanta, I had my CEO and me and another colleague that were going there. We had emailed my CEO with concerns about what we were seeing by way of information about coronavirus. South by Southwest, the big conference had been canceled. Google offices were closing, and we thought that that was significant enough to convince my CEO not to hold an all-staff meeting out in Venice Beach, Los Angeles. However, my CEO, being somewhat of a staunch individual in terms of something like this, kind of blew it off like it was not that serious, and her and a couple other senior colleagues kind of made jokes about not opening door handles with their mouth, and you know, people wanting to go on vacation inevitably, and so my colleague and me, Shakur, we headed on to Atlanta. Shakur lived in LA. He flew back to LA, and I actually detoured, and instead of finishing up my leg to LA, I came back home to Louisville just because I really had an intuition about the gravity of the disease, and that clearly turned out to be right. Before long, our entire organization was grounded and everything was remote. Mm-hmm. Remote life was nothing new to me because I live my life traveling so much that to be connected to our central office in Los Angeles, I had to do Zoom meetings consistently, as well as to the other 20 or 30 offices across the nation that we had.
I'm losing you, Shelton. We back?
You said you're losing me?
I was just a second now. I'm good now. Before we go any further, describe to me what you do for a living.
So I'll tell you what I did first, and then I'll update you about things that have changed and what I'm doing now.
Sure.
So what I was doing at the time of the pandemic, I was the national director of strategic partnerships for the organization called the BAIL Project, and that's BAIL as in B-A-I-L. And what we do is we bail indigent clients out of jail. And we support those indigent clients to help them get their needs met so that they return to court, do not reoffend, and do not miss court. And in that process, our ultimate goal was to open 50 offices across the nation. And that's where I came in, because in my role as partnerships director, I opened 20 plus offices for our organization in less than 2 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And so what I currently do, because I resigned from that position July of 2020, and an organization that I had founded, co-founded with another partner here in Louisville, Kentucky, called the Louisville Community Bail Fund. So if you think Bail Project National, well, the Louisville Community Bail Fund does the same thing, but only locally.
Yeah.
So, and if you were anywhere around Louisville in, you know, August, June, July, August, you know that we had something along with the pandemic happen in Louisville that was as monumental in terms of its impact on the community. And that was a lot of protests and demonstrations. And so the Louisville Community Bail Fund, we got busy right away bailing out demonstrators. We always have been bailing out indigent clients, but, you know, overnight you would get groups of 60 and 40 and 50 incarcerated. And so our work was to bail people out. We believe that the part of the Constitution that suggests that you're innocent until proven guilty should extend to the pretrial justice phase of the system as well. And so we think that if you're held in pretrial confinement, then you've essentially lost the innocent until proven guilty.
Well, so it certainly is an unequal thing when wealthier people don't have to sit in jail and people right. that are poor do.
Right. And that's the gist of it. We fundraise so that people that are poor do get out. And in fact, what we've learned from the data is that poor people that don't have any of their own money involved return to court at the same rates as wealthy people that are bailed out, and that they get much better outcomes. The problem is it's not just that because you're low income that you stay incarcerated, but the data has showed us in the course of the several years we've been doing this work that you get way more favorable outcomes when you're out than when you're in terms of the end of the judicial system. So we bail people out and we support them. So key to that is support. We don't just bail people out to avoid. We make sure that people with mental health difficulties get connected to much needed services. We make sure that people with housing inadequacy, we try to help them to come up with a housing plan. And people with employment and educational difficulties and goals that they outline for themselves, we support them and partner with them to identify and create those networks. So that's what I currently do. That's actually what I was doing, only instead of doing it on a national scale, traveling all over the U.S., I'm doing it here local. And I go pretty regional. So I spend a lot of time. I'll be in Floyd County tonight and right across the bridge. But I spend a lot of time in E-Town and Shelby County and Bullitt County and other places around the Louisville region.
Yeah. Well, I know it certainly is. I know it makes an enormous difference if people have a network they can depend on. I know there was a frontline a few years ago that basically covered people from the west end of Louisville, I think from the Russell neighborhood. And the thing that made the difference is, did they have a church community? Did they have a family? Did they have some kind of network that they could depend on? It would make all the difference.
Yeah.
So good on you. That's a wonderful thing that you're doing.
Thank you. And that frontline documentary was illuminating about not only that aspect of how people sustain and push through, but also just illuminating about disparities
yes.
in a neighborhood.
Absolutely. And I'm sure COVID has just basically put an exponent on those and just made it even worse. So your work basically, you say, has become more regional, local, rather than spread out all over the country. You're doing the same thing, but just more at home. Has that been satisfying to you, Shelton? Shelton?
Yeah, Shelton. Yeah, it's actually been more than satisfying. I tell you, you know, the job that I took of traveling, you know, if you know, it just kind of seemed like a really great opportunity when I first took it, and it definitely was. But I could not have estimated the toll that it would take on my family and relationships and community for me to be absent so much.
Yeah.
And so what was very fulfilling was to be back home and really to be armed with so much new information and so many robust experiences that I could actually bring all of that to bear for my community.
Yes.
So it became and at such a problem. Excuse me.
That's
my
okay.
Dog sees another dog. Okay, sorry about that.
That's okay.
Well,
that's okay.
Give me one moment. He's gonna see another dog as well.
Sure, sure.
Sorry about that. I'm just like a minute from being home, and when he gets close to home, there's lots of dogs that he knows, and he wants
yeah,
to talk to
just people. Saying hello.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to get your daughter in the house and everything?
Yeah, I'll get her situated and I'll be able to be more attentive, and hopefully our internet connection will be strong. I don't know how much I've broken up.
Actually, not that much. Not that
That's
much.
Good. Okay. Just give me one second.
No problem.
Okay, I'm settled down. So you had mentioned about how fulfilling my new role was, and I think I clarified that. I do want to say, just in regard, MLK, I always think about this quote by MLK. He said, when America gets a cold, Black America gets the flu.
Yeah.
And I think, that really speaks to, if you see coronavirus and it's the distress it's causing on, the nation, you can only imagine and magnify just really how impactful that is on the Black community.
Well, especially with the historical with the distress of the medical profession that Blacks have because of the history, really, of that relationship.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, for your work now, with the pandemic factored in, how does it affect what you do? Are you going into the various halls of justice and those sorts of things?
So I am doing that. I tell you, initially, everything kind of stopped. So for it was just these ebbs and flows. Like, people were just like, what do we do? So there was this big, don't let anybody in to halls of justices, clerk's offices. And that lasted for about 2 days. And then, I guess the people sat down and talked. And what they had done was, we had gotten some research from out of China and out of other countries that, COVID had been present for 30, 40, 60 days. And prisons and jails had become such epicenters of the virus.
Oh, yes.
That officials here in the U.S. really started to think of strategies in conjunction with those of us that were really working in reform spaces. They really started thinking of strategies for how to reduce jails and prisons. And so then we actually became popular, right? Because for the longest, a lot of institutions had been pretty resistant to the work that we do. It's just this idea you're bailing out these criminals, And so really quickly, those same previous resistant law enforcement leaders actually turned and said, go ahead and come get our people. And they started letting people out in pretty large numbers. Not as large as we would have wished, though, right? Yeah. We actually wanted no pretrial incarceration, right? We wanted it reduced to zero. And we wanted to really demand that everybody that could be would be released, right? So you had people who have done 6 years on an 8-year sentence. They've got 2 years left. And now, they're in jail with this disease that they can't social distance. They don't have proper PPE. And they're in this concentrated community where one person coughs and, it spreads.
Absolutely.
So, we started to write demand letters nationally all over to jails and institutions, really demanding that our leadership and political officials make the right decision. I tell you, I'm not a critic of Bashir, but I'll tell you, in regards to his policy making and his advising around jail reduction and prisons, he definitely would get a low grade for that on my watch. And not just him, but I could go 50 states because I've done work with several governors and different administrations, and they just don't get it. And there's lots of priorities that are underway. I'll tell you, the populations of people that are most threatened also have the least political power. So as you talk always. Nursing homes, limited to no political power. You talk jails and prisons, limited to no political power. And so, politicians are going to pay attention to them a little bit less than they are a group of nurses at a nursing association, or doctors, and et cetera, et cetera. So things opened up in some ways shortly thereafter for us, because officials saw money and getting people out, and it's reducing the jails. Trust in Bedfellow, we found ourselves collaborating with, and I still snicker just to even think about this group, is the Corrections Union.
Whoa.
So, yeah.
Odd,
yeah.
Strange Bedfellows.
I tell you, you think about, you know, unions in regards to law enforcement, and generally they're not, there's not a lot of collaboration. But this is the interesting part. We got this call, Washington State Corrections Union. They were scared. Their officers were getting sick. They had officers that were months from retirement that had been cancer survivors. And they were trying to figure out solutions. And to them, less people in jail meant less potential virus.
Absolutely.
And so we started collaborating, writing letters on behalf of corrections unions, making demands, because their officials above them were not even listening to them. Right. And so, you know, I'm proud to have been part of the reduction of jails across the nation. I think we've reduced almost to 80s level, which, you know, we always knew that we didn't have to have a balloon of prisons and jails.
Well, that was kind of before the for-profits really took off, wasn't it?
You know, let me say this. So we use this term for-profits, but I tell you, that's somewhat of a scapegoat.
Okay. Yeah?
Even state and jail prisons, the budget that goes to them are massive, in the billions. We just think about for-profit because it's so obvious. But I'll tell you what a state corrections officer told my friend Glenn when Glenn was on his way out of jail. He looked at Glenn and he said, "Glenn, thank you." He said, "You help buy my boat. And when your son comes back, he'll help buy my son's boat." So I can't really stress enough that it's like, yes, that is a pariah, but the whole institution is a pariah. In the 80s, we had 400,000 people incarcerated across the nation. And by the 2000s, we had over 2.5 million. So, you know, like, that's clearly not just for nonprofit. I mean, for profits. That's the whole damn thing. Because we started passing policy. We started calling young people super predators. We started, you know, giving sentences of 85% truthful sentencing. And we really made a caste system of Black boys ages 18 to 25, to the degree that, you know, the national data was suggesting that one out of every three Black African-American males age 18 to 24 would spend time in jails and prisons.
Yeah.
That's not for profit. That's the whole damn system.
Yeah. God, that's a horrible statistic.
I mean, we really push the envelope on Gestapo and those horrific things that happen.
What kind of precautions are you seeing in the prison? Are they able to, is there any kind of social distancing at all they can do?
No. So, you know, Madison County Jail was just on fire. So I call coronavirus, and I like to liken it to a fire. Mm-hmm. So Madison County, Kentucky, they just had like,
That's probably the most massive
spread, you know? And mm-hmm. I mean, you know, so we talk to people in jail every day. They tell me, they say, on Monday, they gave me a mask. They haven't washed my laundry for over 3 weeks. And my mask now is about as thick as a piece of toilet paper 12 days later.
Oh my gosh, that's horrible.
People are going in with masks. They're confiscating the masks that people bring in, and they're giving them, you know, the kind of paper masks. And And so, you know, I liken it to a fire, because I think about it like this, you know, if I looked up and my local county jail was on fire, would I justify leaving people in there to burn out of a community safety sense? Or do I also have a responsibility to life and liberty for those that are inside that building?
Yes.
I believe as a fireman, I would probably rush in there and save their lives. And yes, that is what is not happening in the state of Kentucky, because there's no political will and they're politically powerless, because we have disenfranchisement of people that are in and disenfranchisement of people that are on parole and probation and disenfranchisement of people that have various level charges. And that's because that many people are disenfranchised, they'll never have a fighting chance. When you take away the power to vote, they have no leverage in which to challenge politicians to do the right thing on their behalf. And so you have to hope that people in the community care. And the difficulty is, as loving and compassionate as people are, I was at an intersection the other day. And at that intersection, Peggy, I happened to hear the sound of chirps. And they were in association with the walk, do not walk sign.
Yeah.
And that was for blind people. Now, Peggy, because I'm not blind, I don't think about accessibility at the level in which people that are blind think about accessibility.
Sure.
And so if I wanted to create policy and practice and procedure, I probably need some blind people in that conversation. Yeah. If I'm going to get it right. And unfortunately, Governor Beshear and his cabinet administrators only have people that don't have the experience at the table. They're just not getting it right.
Yeah, I'm really sorry to hear that. I mean, I've interviewed some people out in the state and they talk about their COVID rates and they go, well, that's just the prison. And I'm thinking, but they're people, for heaven's sakes.
You know? Yeah, well. No, I mean, I think that's telling, just that right there. When that's just the prison, when they say that, it clearly you have a clear understanding about who's deserving and who's not.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And all the and also along with it, the unfairness of just who gets incarcerated in this country, for sure.
Yeah. 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 Well, you know, every day we see someone released that was found DNA. And we see it every day. Brian Stevens, who wrote the book Just Mercy and founder of EJI, he says, you know, if airplanes, if we had the fail rate that we do with the death penalty as we do with airplanes, we would stop flying.
Yeah,
you know, it's such a catastrophe.
That was a wonderful book too. He's a fantastic guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, in terms of your family and everything, what kind of suffering have they had as a result of COVID?
Yeah, so thank you for saying that. I actually just came from a funeral.
Oh, no. I know you were talking about that.
Yeah, so, you know, I don't know if COVID has exacerbated opioid addiction and overdoses by way of, but for me and my family, in less than 10 months, I've had 3 relatives under 45 years old pass from overdose, the youngest one being 24, of them siblings.
Oh, that poor mother.
Well, and she's deceased. My aunt's deceased when they were really young. Not from an overdose, thank God, but from malpractice. So, you know, it's to be Black in America, it's almost like invisible when Black folks die of overdoses. You know, we saw, you know, this really different response to what's called the opioid epidemic versus crack cocaine.
Right.
When crack cocaine was at the precipice, you know, it was demonizing the Black folk that were participating, and there was no medical response. And in this world of opioids and overdoses, kind of back to political power, you know, when you start having, you know, middle class, you know, to well-to-do white folks, kids dying of overdoses, you start getting people paying attention. And so although there is attention being paid because of the, you know, multiple years of disenfranchisement and just really just a beat down community, those solutions have not permeated in the Black community. I spend a lot of time in jails. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you so an interesting observation, Peggy, in jails all over the nation, I can go into a jail and I'll see immediate disparity in terms of demographics of people in the jails. And then if I go to a diversion program, it's like complete opposite. If it's a drug abuse diversion program, 85% to 90% of the participants will be white. Mm-hmm. If it's a jail, traditional jail cell, 85 to 95% of the occupants will be Black and brown. And so, you know, it's kind of like waiting for Superman.
Yeah. Well, I know that one of the things in regard to COVID and drug overdoses, and I think this doesn't have a racial aspect, is just isolation of people. That, you know, people that really need to be surrounded by a program or by family or what have you, that they're out there in their apartments all by themselves, many of them out of work. And I mean, that kind of stress just pulls you over to the other side.
Yeah. And then you throw in fentanyl and, you know, you throw in all these other factors that really just start to, you know, contribute, you know, whether climate and, you know, the racial injustice treatment. Just it's been a really difficult year, to say the least.
Do you think the pandemic has been politicized?
So you know, I think everything is easily able to be politicized.
Uh-huh.
I think that the pandemic, you know, and I say this tentatively, is just really truly a pandemic in all its aspects that all of us needed to be on the same accord with to come up with the necessary solutions to move us into sustainability and health. And there have been numerous actors that have utilized the pandemic for various means. You saw immediately people with wealth dumping stock before even the general public was completely aware that this thing was as dangerous as it was.
Some of them in the Congress.
People that were congresswomen in particular, that's no longer a congresswoman.
That's correct.
And so when you say like, I mean, I think people will leverage opportunity wherever there may be, whether it's leveraging it for political gain or leveraging it for financial gain. And so to that regard, there's been politicization. But I think that if we get too caught up in the noise around the politicization, then we get into this paradigm in which, you know, is it real or is it not real? And you know, I think just like, hey, this pandemic and this sickness and this disease and this illness is as real as oxygen.
Yeah.
And if you don't protect yourself, just like you can't live without oxygen, you're not going to be safe in this pandemic.
I guess what I'm thinking about is that to wear a mask has become a political statement.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, simple thing, but you got a mask on, you're on one side versus if you don't, you're on the other.
Yeah, no, I mean, 100%. It was funny though, because when you watched what happened in DC, surprisingly enough, a lot of them had masks on.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that was for the autonomy, the anonymity. I don't know if that was for the anonymity, because there comes a lot of anonymity with being behind a mask, but lots of them had masks on. I actually had considered not going to the services of my family because I think sometimes when we think political, because our political divides are oftentimes so black and white, I'll tell you that in terms of mask wearing, it's not always that crystal clear, right? So my sister, Thanksgiving, had a little family get together, and as people would come through the door, she would ask people to wear their mask. One of the people that didn't wear his mask was my deceased cousin, whose service I went to today. And when he was told to wear his mask, he didn't come into the house.
Aww.
He wasn't doing that as a political statement. He was doing that more as kind of like it was a personal affront to suggest that he might have the illness.
Yeah.
And so I think kind of like, you know, suggesting that somebody hasn't brushed their teeth and the embarrassment that comes with that. I think that that was his response. And interesting enough, a few weeks prior to Thanksgiving, his girlfriend who worked in the nursing profession had been diagnosed with coronavirus. So he had a personal connection to somebody, but still wanted to just kind of stand in this space of, I can't believe you think I might have coronavirus. And so I don't, you know, that wasn't super political, right? That was more personal. And I don't know how to deviate between the two.
It's a hard
based
call.
On lived experience and how people kind of, you know, come to this place in the world.
Yeah. Well, one aside here, now that we're spoke about the vaccine, is have you been able to get your vaccine?
I haven't. I'm
you
not
should
a
be front and center. Come on, Shelton.
Well, I'm not a frontline worker as the traditional frontline worker. And my nonprofit organization would not probably get recognized as anything like, a doctor's office or a preschool child care provider. I don't know. I mean, maybe we should do some digging to see how we could get on the list.
I urge you to do that. I really do. My daughter's a psychologist, and she just told me today that she's starting to see, she does a lot of custody cases and that sort of thing. And mm-hmm. she's got to see one person right now, a child that she has to see, and that qualified her for the vaccine. Now, okay. I mean, I'm happy she's getting it, but I'm holding that up to what you're doing, Shelton. And it doesn't hold a candle to that. So I really urge you to
yeah.
do something.
Well, you know, sometimes it's not what you know, it's who you know.
That's the truth. That's the truth. But so, I guarantee, in your work, you know a lot of people.
Well, I do. I know a colleague of mine who just recently got the vaccine. He works with people with severe head injuries. And I was kind of astonished, like, didn't really seem like the population most threatened, but they were able to get at the top of the list and they recently got vaccinated. I think it's about finding out his employer, his boss, she found out who there was to contact and contacted him and got her team on the list. And so I think we need to do some digging at the health department to see.
Please do pull the strings if you got them, because what you're doing is really, really vital. And the last thing you need is COVID.
Yeah, no, I hear that. And I mean, I think every day I wake up and I thank God, here we are almost a year into coronavirus and, you know, to have made it this long, you know, while there is a vaccination. So I'm not in any way taking it for granted.
All right. Well, one thing you said, you weren't too high on Bashir in terms of his ability to get people out of the prison system, especially in the face of the pandemic. What do you think about the overall pandemic? How has he done?
Yeah, I mean, I liked his father and I like him. I mean, you know, and yet I also can be extremely critical where I think that they're coming up short. And I do. I think in a lot of ways, he's gotten in front. You know, we're to me, I'm proud to be a Kentuckian with some of the policies, the mask wearing, the limitations in restaurants and various things. I total agreement, and I totally adhere and support him and knowing the opposition that he's up against, you know, I reserve my criticism in the face of that opposition, because I know that they're, you know, really trying, you know, by law to put forth policy that would even put Kentucky in so much danger. So, you know, I definitely have appreciation for what he has done that has been vital to keeping our numbers very low level.
Yeah, yeah. Well, at the national level, I guess it's been kind of a mess this first year, but do you have some hope that it'll be turned around a little bit now that we've got a new administration?
Yeah, I definitely am hopeful. You know, I was listening the other day, and, you know, Biden, they made a commitment, I think a million doses a day, maybe.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I heard some research that suggested that we're already at a million doses a day. It's just not enough, that we need to be at 2 million doses a day to really move the needle. And so that, I gotta say, that's a little scary, you know, that you hold out hope for this new administration to be effective, and then you quickly find out that what they're considering effective, you know, is relative, you know. And so, yeah, you know,
well, Fauci said the other day that Biden had made that basically statement at a time when it really looked like a million doses a day was almost not achievable, and then suddenly it became achievable, so he almost needs to roll it back. But at any rate, hopefully, you know, we will begin to get the rate of vaccine supply up so that everybody can get their vaccine.
Yeah.
Now, Shelton, you've already told me something I always at this point ask, has anything good happened to you as a result of the pandemic? And I know you basically said coming home and being more in this region has been a good thing. Anything else you can think of that the pandemic has done that's positive?
Yeah. So I haven't been a dog owner. I haven't had a dog since I was probably 10 years old. So
there you go.
I'm a dog owner and of a strapping 10-month-old Airedale.
Well, that brings some joy into your life.
Yeah, joy and work. I couldn't think of anything better than that. That's definitely been a blessing.
Shelton, I want to talk a little bit about the racial unrest that I've been very close to because I live in Old Louisville. I haven't been able to be as much a part of it because of my age, but what I could go to, I went to. So many people I've talked to out in the state have been acting like the whole city's been torn down. And I always tell them, I don't think so. You know, it's just, you know, the news covers things and glorifies the parts that make news. And it's kind of sad because it gives a false impression of really what's come down. But do you think the pandemic any way affected the racial unrest that we know was that came about because of Breonna and David McAtee and George Floyd and others that was going to be there? But has the pandemic made it worse?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the pandemic did a little bit more than just make it worse, but it also made it best. Yeah. I think that you could not have mobilized people on the level that you were able to mobilize them had they been challenged with all of the things that pacify us in the United States.
Yeah.
You know, people would have been on spring break instead of demanding justice for Breonna.
Yeah.
People would have been at their amusement parks and they would have been, you know, watching their favorite baseball teams and basketball teams. And so,
or working at their jobs that they at lost.
Being, are working in their jobs in restaurants and et cetera. And all of those things being closed momentarily,
created this space where people could attend to things.
Yeah.
You know, almost like in like the Arab Spring. So, you know, they're countries that don't have much pacification, right? And so when in those countries, unrest was necessary to create justice, people showed up.
Yeah.
Countries weren't challenged with all the things that challenge us and pull us, you know, I really want to support, you know, this guy that I watched the police step on his neck, but right after these 10 episodes of Sex in the City, you know, that's the United States. And something changed where, you know, you could only watch so many episodes before you were tired and you had to wake up and look up, and on your screen was horrific violence and brutality of Black people. And I think that somebody who never would have came out. And I think that people that weren't as aware became aware. So
yeah. It influenced, it had a substantial, I think sociologists will have their job cut out for them.
Yes.
As they archive and really depict and illustrate just what happened and how the pandemic has played so many different roles in multiple areas. I mean, even people's attentiveness to the political agendas and, you know, the politics of the U.S. You know, how long have we seen low voter turnout? I mean, like here in Kentucky, there's no better example of low voter turnout.
Yeah.
That's all we know.
Yeah, and then, sad.
You know, it's sad. Like 20% of Kentuckians elected the officials for 100% of Kentuckians. And that's typical.
Yeah.
So the pandemic seemed to have made people pay attention.
Yeah. And of course, the stress of unemployment, of losing your house, of moving to a shelter, all those sorts of things, I think, exacerbated it, don't you?
Yeah. I think when you say pandemic, I think pandemic should be a loaded term that includes all of that.
I've been calling the racial unrest the pandemic within the pandemic, really.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if there's an opioid epidemic, and there's a pandemic, then I think just having other segments within the larger idea is super what it's like in the United States of America 2020 to present day 2021. And, you know, I'd hate to be a philosopher or a prophet, but please, let's hope that no unjust killing like that happens in the next near future, because I don't know if America, I don't know what'll happen with America if we continue to see those type of things happen with the people are paying attention now.
Cell phone cameras. Cell phone cameras, just like the TV cameras of the 1960s in places like Birmingham. Now you've got people with cell phone cameras.
Yeah.
And it's a whole different ballgame. It's hard for me to understand how policemen can do what they do and know that the cell phone cameras out there are going to catch them. It's just, that's a hard psychology for me to understand, even if you're not looking at the morality of it, which is a hard thing to ignore.
Yeah.
Hopefully we'll get some different policies with regard to policing with the new administration. We'll see.
Yeah. Now that I'm not holding out as much hope for.
Yeah.
When you talk about the pandemic, I am hopeful. Policing in America, I have very minuscule hope for policing in America. In fact, I have very minuscule hope for race relations in America. I do believe that it's only been incremental. I think about the time period between emancipation, Reconstruction, and the passage of the Civil Rights Act.
Yeah.
Like literally, people were fighting to use the same toilet as another race of people in the 1960s. Emancipation happened in 1865. Mm-hmm. And literally, 200 years later, people are fighting just to use a water fountain.
Yeah.
If that's not incremental.
Well, it's just like you, for Black men, you took them out of slavery and you put them in the prisons.
Yeah. And so that, to me, I think that the wins that we see, Peggy, are so minuscule compared to the need.
Yeah.
That, you know, when you say police reform, what are we talking about?
Yeah.
You know, we watched Rodney King, you and I, that was on tape. Yeah. They walked off with no accountability. And we all just went back to our Super Bowls and our basketballs and hoped that it wasn't one of us next. And we were in a void for 20 years because cell phone cameras weren't captured.
Yeah.
But, you know, people were getting killed. People were dying. You know, and even today, like when I think about Breonna Taylor and the no-knock warrants, I've had a no-knock warrant issued on my home before. Like, who's going to go back? Like, I want the Metro Council. I want us to go back and review 25 years of no-knock warrants.
Of course.
And where we find discrepancies, lies, and inappropriate actions, you know, erase people's records, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, like, you think about reparations, the argument for reparations, right? Yeah. And, you know, we're 400 years later, you know, like, and people think like, oh, you know, like that happened like so historically, like why? I mean, what about today, present day things that have happened with housing, you know, the housing segregation that left Black families with little to no wealth in comparison to white families. Like these things are documented, researchable, and yet we still have no motivation to do anything about it. And, you know, police reform, I mean, I could line you up, Black people that have been brutalized by the police, and nobody's, you know, unless you're dead and you got fortunate as Breonna did, that, you know, the national public found out about it, you know, you just keep going and just hope, you know, that there is an afterlife. I mean, like, Black people have a responsibility to hope for an afterlife like no other group of people, because this life is oftentimes extremely unbearable.
Yeah.
Well, back to the pandemic, 50 to 100 years from now, and not just the pandemic, but the racial aspects, what do you think historical people that are analyzing this period are going to say?
So I want to try to say this and be as non-pessimistic as possible, because I do have hope. I love this country. The wealth disparities, the access in America that's limited for Black Americans, quite possibly 50 years from now, will be so exaggerated it's, you know, some people don't even believe that Native Americans exist in the United States of America today.
Yeah.
And why would that be? Well, if you look around, there's very little proof that they exist. But for
a few names of communities, names of streets. If the hunter tells the story, they'll always be glorious.
Yeah.
Maybe 50 years from now, Black people will be very similar to Native Americans. Forgotten. Not existent. A few names of buildings and streets after Black people.
Well, you're a younger population, though, and white people are getting old. And so, and that's one thing I think we can look at as is basically the rise in power of people of color just from the numbers, really. That may have something to say about it.
But I think if things held out well, then you would be right. But if you have pandemics that disproportionately kill races of people, then you're and not only that, but if you have political movements like the one we just saw, that are determined to roll back civil rights legislation. We're seeing it now. What's the legislation that made it possible for African Americans to access college at equitable and fair? Lawsuits coming against it.
Yeah.
So I tell you that there is a movement against, when that data came out, that data point, Peggy, that came out that said in 50 years, the browning of America, that came out about 5 years ago. And the worst thing about that information was it galvanized an entire group of people that are determined to make America white again.
So sad.
Yeah. Because
started a revolution on that side for sure.
That's the origin of that statement. It's not good again.
Yeah.
It's white again. That was the origin of that statement from the Klan. And that statement is in full effect. And so when you ask me about 50 years from now, it would not be astonishing to me to see elements of that gentleman's family rise to power, be back in the White House, and be moving that self-same agenda forward with the momentum of death. I mean, these people are fighting for what they believe is the death of what they held all things true in America. And that's access to privilege, to the demise of other people.
It sure isn't a movement for democracy, that's for sure.
No, not even close. Yeah. Not even close. Anytime you want ballots to not be counted, anytime you know, these are ballots from soldiers across seas. Throw them away. Don't count them.
It's just mind-boggling. I mean, this is like the worst storybook you ever had made up, that something like this could be happening, and yet it did. And it's all documented, and we saw it on TV.
Yep.
So sad.
Yep.
Let me ask you, maybe when the acute phase of this pandemic is over with, maybe when you've gotten your vaccine and others have, what do you think the new normal is going to be like?
So, I think it will be interesting for me to sit in a restaurant.
Yeah.
We're resilient people and we have short-term memory loss oftentimes. I would imagine that a large population of folks want to get back to the old way at such a high rate that they haven't let a lot of things go. And that's why we've continued to have our COVID numbers the way they are, because people just aren't stopping, right?
Yeah.
Unless it's mandated, unless you have good leadership that gets in there and puts up some guardrails and challenges people to do the right thing. We had to do it with smoking.
Yeah.
You know,
and look at us now, right? Yeah. Peggy, there was a time where you and I would go to a restaurant and the smallest section in the restaurant was the no smoking section.
Yeah.
And what a laugh, right? Because that what did that really mean when you think back to what those sections were like what were you preventing me from breathing?
I remember
that JCC, was a small section.
I remember JCC in the HB building, they had an end of the hall where you could smoke and an end of the hall where you couldn't smoke. Like that made any sense.
Yeah. Made a whole lot, right? And that was the world that we were in.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's where my deepest hope comes from. Coming up during that period where every single automobile was made with a cigarette lighter and an ashtray, and to be sitting where we're sitting today, that gives me hope.
Yes, I agree.
That
I
we
agree.
Can do it. We can do it.
Yeah. Well, that's all my questions. Have you got anything else you'd like to have on the in the archive?
No, I appreciate Dr. Newberry and Judy Jennings for suggesting. I really pleasure to have met you. I'm sorry that we hadn't crossed paths in the, 28 years that you've been at JCTC. I wasn't only an educator there. I cut my teeth as a student there. Uh-huh. What an honor to be with somebody that's been in same spaces. And I hope that as you continue to archive these stories, that you'll get so much diversity and so much color that 50 years from now, it'll be so illuminating to my children's children's children.
Well, I'm honored to talk to you, Shelton. And one thing I might ask for you is if you know somebody that would want to talk and you would want to see their story in the archive, please send them my way.
Yeah, I'm going to send you
Chanel. Know they're a good reference.
I'm going to send you Chanel Helm.
Okay.
The leader of Black Lives Matter Louisville.
Fantastic. That would be a wonderful addition. I would really be so grateful.
Okay.
Because that's a voice that's important to hear, certainly.
Yeah, I'm going to make that connection for you via email when we get off of here, and hopefully you all can take it from there and she can be captured in this archive as well.
Well, thank you so much for giving me this part of your evening. It's so nice to have met you.
Pleasure,
Peggy. Our paths will cross again.
I hope so. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yep. Stay safe. Peace.